I know we're going to be talking about Uncharted very shortly, but of course everyone will talk about Uncharted and they'll make comparisons to all of the bad video game movies that we've had in, you know, the past 10 years. I'm still sort of holding out hope for two projects that are on the horizon, though. They just announced that Walton Goggins has been cast in the Amazon show based on Fallout, which I'm kind of psyched about because, you know, Walton Goggins, he's done drama, but he's also better known lately as a comedy actor. And if they're hiring a guy who has comedy chops, I feel like that's an indication that they may be getting the sense of humor from the games, right? Which is probably the most important step, considering it's like a post-apocalyptic story slash landscape. You know, you can't just do a depressing post-apocalyptic thing like that Viggo Mortensen movie, The Road. Like, that's not what Fallout is. So I feel like by casting Walton Goggins, they're on a good foot. Now, the fact that it's the people who made Westworld, I don't know. You know, Jonathan Nolan and his...
I thought you liked Westworld.
I liked the first season, but then I heard that, you know, it got a really bad reception in seasons 2 and 3, and I didn't catch up with it, so I don't know for sure. But yeah, I'm holding out hope that the video game curse doesn't hit that one. Also, Netflix is making a Bioshock movie.
I've heard about that too.
It's another game series that I love. Yeah, fingers crossed on that one.
The thing about post-apocalyptic movies and adaptations is that they all tend to be depressing. Which is kind of why it was interesting in Lego Movie, the second one, I think it was. They had the post-apocalyptic world and they made it like a comedy. Same with Zombieland.
Yeah.
So it's funny that you mentioned that because he directed Uncharted. So yeah, I agree. Like, I think it's especially, I don't know, coming out of COVID, I think people are just looking for a bit more positivity.
Yeah, exactly. You know, we've all experienced our own form of like, you know, end times.
Although we're about to get like the most psychotic Batman ever. Yeah. I'm excited for it. So.
Oh, of course, but that will be the topic for next episode. So for all of you listening at home, get excited for that because I'm sure we'll have lots of thoughts about that coming from two Batman diehards.
Oh, for sure.
But on that note, should we start the show?
Sure.
Welcome to the Extra Buttery Podcast. It's a show about movies, TV, anything with a story and actors on a screen, really. Join Jason Chan and Robert Snow's free-flowing conversation with deep dives into characters and plot with the occasional salty opinion. So get your popcorn. I got mine right here. Let's start the show!
Welcome to episode 105 of the Extra Buttery Podcast. This is Robert Snow in Toronto, and I'm joined by my co-host Jason Chen in Vancouver.
Hi.
This time on the show, we're talking Uncharted. Teased a little bit in the intro just then, but it's the long-in-development Sony adaptation of the beloved video game series. And then we're also going to touch on Paul Thomas Anderson's latest, Licorice Pizza, which came out holiday 2021, but, you know, due to some fun times with COVID here in Canada, it took a while for Jason and I to see it. So we'll be talking about that. But swinging back over to the video games again.
This is the path the Ferdinand Magellan took to sail around the world.
You know your history.
It's the biggest treasure that's never been found.
5 billion, easy. I think you're here because you're your brother.
Well, you know my brother, Sam.
But now I smell the rain, and with it, and it's heading my way.
If you find that gold, you find him too.
Yes, I'll keep on.
I think I wrote this in the review that's up on the site, but arguably the more interesting part about Uncharted isn't so much the movie at all. It's the long, long journey it took to finally get made.
You didn't find it boring, did you?
I found it very meh. Like, there were moments that were fine, there were moments that were really dull, and they kind of canceled each other out for me. So I was like squarely in the middle on it. You know, I feel like I might forget it in a couple months' time. But it wasn't bad. Like, there were people who were kind of like cheering for it to be bad, like, you know, that's so bad it's good kind of vibe, but there's no way that it could be like that. I don't think it doesn't have enough personality for me.
No.
I don't know. What did you think of it?
Well, before we get into it, do you want to intro the movie and the plot first before we
dive in? That's an important part. So Uncharted is based on the video game series from Naughty Dog, a game studio. The series has led to, I think, 5 installments so far, with a couple of spin-offs here and there, like card games, things like that. But it has
There's 5?
5 games. I think there's 4 games with Nathan Drake and then one with Chloe Frazier as the lead. She pops up in this movie.
Oh, I didn't know there was a 5th one with Chloe, but okay.
Yeah, that's what the Wikipedia thing was telling me. But
they're fun games, though. I love the games.
And here's the thing. I'd never played the games. Maybe because I'd never had we weren't much of like a PlayStation house growing up. So I never had a PlayStation. So, and the games were always Sony exclusives. But I was aware of the series. I knew that it drew a lot of inspiration from Indiana Jones and other kind of treasure hunting adventurer type stories. Mm-hmm. And the other thing that I knew about it, following the video game industry, was that it was a series that was well known for its cinematic cutscenes, where there was lots of dialogue. There was lots of kind of quippy character moments between the hero, Nathan Drake, and the various people he comes across when he's searching the world for antiquities. And so, I mean, it made sense for Sony to try to make this into a movie years and years ago, back in 2007, 2008, when they first started developing it. And I think I would prefer to see a documentary on just how many twists and turns this thing took in production. It had 6 different directors attached before Ruben Fleischer took over, director of Zombieland, like you pointed out before. And yet, you know, here we are, 2022, the things finally come out. Tom Holland was cast in 2017, but they didn't actually start shooting until 2020 because it took them 3 years to get like a better script. I guess they must have rewrote it God knows how many times.
I didn't know he was cast that early.
Yeah, that was what I was reading. So, and now granted, maybe he was cast in 2017 and his stuff with Marvel kind of kept him from being able to start. I don't know. This has been pitched all along or for a long time as this new starring vehicle for Tom Holland, you know, a chance to see him in a different IP instead of Spider-Man. And it's an origin story. So we have Nathan Drake as this bartender who was orphaned at a young age, split up with his brother who had been taking care of him for a while. But the two of them both had this strong interest in the expedition of Magellan back in the 16th century. And they felt that the treasure ships that Magellan had hidden away could still be found. And that in today's money, it would be worth $5 billion with a B if you could track these things down and sell them somehow. And of course, you know, just the right characters end up crossing Nathan Drake's path in this movie so that his adventure can begin. And he meets up with Sully, played by Mark Wahlberg, who is this experienced adventurer who also knows about the Magellan treasure. And of course, some bad guys headed by Antonio Banderas as Santiago Moncada, this aristocratic Spanish guy who believes that his family is owed the treasure after his family was cheated of it back in the 16th century. And that's your basic setup. I mean, it reminds me a lot of the recent Alicia Vikander version of Tomb Raider.
They're all similar. Like, the games are all similar.
Yeah, which, you know, is to be expected given the fact that we're dealing with, like, going after historical artifacts and things like that. Between the fact that Indiana Jones itself as a series is not fully dead, with Harrison Ford shooting a new one as of last year, this feels, and the fact that like the Mummy is kind of still around or still beloved by certain fans, like this one
like the Brendan Fraser one, right?
Yes.
Not the Tom Cruise.
Oh yes. Yeah.
The,
yeah.
The Brendan Fraser one is amazing.
Exactly.
I love it. It's one of my favorite adventure movies. Actually, the parallel I drew was National Treasure.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah. There's that too. I mean, and both of those movies were also, you know, still held up as great fun adventure movies that we don't really get enough of. And so this one comes along and, you know, it's not like I was saying before, it's not bad by any stretch of the imagination, but it's also not super memorable.
No, it's not. But I think, like you said, it reminds us too much of other franchises that deal with the same treasure hunting trope starring a white dude.
Yeah.
I mean, you could pull like 100 movies out of, you know, your butt just, you know, with that topic alone.
Yeah.
I agree with you there. I think it's a competent film. I don't think it's very memorable, but I don't think it's bad. And if you like stick it in the pantheon of video game movies, I actually think they did a pretty good job. It follows a lot of the structure from the video games, where you start with like Nathan Drake in being in this sort of a huge action set piece, and then they kind of go back in time and then go through the plot and catch up to the events of the beginning of the film.
Right.
So, yeah, that was kind of nice. The thing about this movie, and as with most video game movies, I find is that the characters are never really in danger. Like, they can't be, right?
Mm, yeah.
And I think they actually did a fairly decent job of not putting Tom Holland, or I should say Nathan Drake, in situations where death is imminent.
Mm, yeah.
I mean, when you jump out of a plane or get hit by a car, or, you know, get hit by cargo, you should be dead on impact.
Yes. Yes.
But he's not.
Yeah. That big scene in the second act or whatever. Yeah.
Yeah. So in that sense, it does feel very much like a video game movie. It does feel like we are watching a Nathan Drake video game in movie form. But my gripes kind of had to do with other things. One of which was being that I cannot unsee Spider-Man.
Oh, yeah.
Especially when he's like jumping around with the lights, and you know, in a couple of the fight scenes where he's doing all sorts of acrobatics, it really, really reminds me of Spider-Man. I don't know if you got the same feeling.
I wasn't so much like thinking of Spider-Man, but I was finding myself questioning occasionally, like, all right, this guy is supposed to be a pickpocket on the streets of New York, granted, and he's in really great shape. We see him working out, but he's still a bartender, and it's not immediately obvious why he would need to be such a great fighter, for example.
I think the bartender is a ruse for him meeting rich people so they could pickpocket.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. That,
I think that's the sort of like connotation, but, I mean, the comparisons we drew, so Indiana Jones, National Treasure, I think this is where Uncharted really falls apart. It is not a very interesting plot.
Yeah.
The sort of like clues and treasure maps that they find aren't very interesting. National Treasure, I thought, was really fun because it introduced you to like an alternate history and objects that you've never heard before. Magellan's ships and treasure is something that like everybody knows.
Right. Yeah. And even when they get to the main like puzzle solving portion of this movie.
Oh my God. It is so bad. Okay. Spoiler alert, but the part where he's in the Philippines and he...
Oh, drives the motorboat right past the beach where the villains are?
No, not that part. The part where he finds the actual spot of the ships and he's using the two crosses as a compass. That was the most ridiculous thing I've ever seen. It is so unclever. Yeah. And the whole turning of the keys and going to Barcelona and following this treasure map. I mean, I think it's more poorly constructed than like a Dan Brown novel.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Actually, I remember writing in the review, like some of the puzzle solving, like the symbology scenes from the Ron Howard movies are better than some of the things that we get in this movie. And I don't know if that's
I don't think we get any of it in this movie.
Well, when we do, it's like, it just feels like a ripoff of better sequences in other movies. Like, you know, all of
the
stuff where they're navigating those hidden passages in Barcelona, it feels complicated, but weirdly simple. Like
it's rudimentary.
Yeah.
Right?
It feels like
it's like hidden keys, hidden walkways. Yeah.
And I'm like, how could no one in Barcelona have found any of these places over the many centuries, just like building buildings that are right on top of this stuff, you know?
Yeah, exactly. At least with National Treasure, he had those like Benjamin Graham glasses that like change color. You can see the secret text. I mean, in this movie, like all they did was write with invisible ink, which is just like lemon, right?
Yeah, lemon juice. Yeah, that's a classic one. Yeah, yeah.
It seems so simple but not elegant in the same way as, say, like Gregory Peck in North by Northwest, where he like traces over a note with a pencil and he gets the outline of the secret message. I mean, if you look at the screenplay, though, like the screenwriters, so Rafe Lee Judkins is one of the screenwriters. He wrote The Wheel of Time.
Mm.
I only caught a few episodes. That's a very straightforward, you know, not so mysterious show about this fantasy world. And then Art Markham and Matt Holloway is a screenwriting duo. They wrote Transformers The Last Knight, Men in Black International. So it's not like it's not like an A-list team, like it's a competent team, because Art Markham and Matt Holloway did write Iron Man, the original one.
Right.
But it's just like all their movies lack, I think, a certain amount of intrigue. And I think you need a lot of intrigue in an adventure movie to keep you going.
Yes.
I mean, half the charm of the movie is Mark Wahlberg and Tom Holland trading barbs back and forth. And it's not even that interesting.
No, they're like, I can't really remember offhand any of the barbs or the banter or anything like that. And, you know, your point about the screenwriters is important too, because for all of the names that are officially like listed on IMDb, there's probably countless ghostwriters who were doing punch-ups and rewrites over the 14 years this thing was being developed.
Yeah.
So who knows how many bits and pieces have been taken from one draft like years ago and are kept in, even though they don't really make sense anymore. You know, I feel like you can see some of those edits on screen occasionally, like the whole part when Chloe Frazier is just written out of the climax entirely. They come up with an excuse for for her to go off and follow a different trail. And, you know, she had been a pretty important supporting.
She was a significant character. Yeah. She was the turncoat.
Exactly. And she's just not in the final action scene with the flying boats or at all. You know,
that feels like a video game thing where like the side characters have to go away and you're on a solo mission.
Right.
And you have to fight the final boss. That feels like a very video game thing. Did you go into the deep dive on IMDb? Because Naughty Dog apparently approached Seth Rogen and Evan Goldberg to write the screenplay.
Really?
Yeah, they did. And then they declined, saying that it would be another Indiana Jones movie.
Oh.
And you totally get that vibe. Like, it's really hard to separate Nathan Drake from the rest of the action adventure series. Because Nathan Drake, what is he? He's a white dude who wears a white shirt and has a gun.
Yeah.
And there's nothing that interesting about that. The other actually interesting tidbit I found was that apparently Tom Holland was cast as Nathan Drake because he had pitched a young James Bond movie to Sony.
Oh, all right.
Which is just weird, because Tom Holland doesn't strike me as a sort of suave super spy type.
No.
He's a high school punk kid who's very talented.
It might be, but I think like we also haven't seen a lot of him acting with his natural, like his actual accent either. You know, he's almost always doing his American accent, and I feel like indeed to get like the James Bond vibe, you do have to have the British accent or a British accent of some kind.
He just doesn't have that edginess to him. Like, he's almost too friendly.
Yeah. So, I mean, I'd be happy to see him try it out. But, it's all kind of academic at this point.
And it's also, like, I get they're trying to build, like, a new franchise and IP, so they skewed young. But Nathan Drake in the video games is, like, in his late 20s, 30s, it seems like. And Sully is white hair.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, I mean, yeah, you could say that Nathan Drake he's almost be like mid-30s at certain points in the... Yeah.
Yeah. So some of the stuff he does seem kind of unbelievable.
Yeah.
But again, this is a video game movie. And you know what? It looks like it's going to be a financial hit, which you can't say about a lot of video game movies.
True. Days. Yeah.
I can just say it's a competently made film based on a video game that ultimately, I think, does feel loyal to the video game itself. And I feel like sometimes that's all you can ask for. And my other question would be, why isn't it that the people who write the plot for the video games also writing the plot for the movie?
Yeah, I think it would be cool to see Naughty Dog brought in maybe in a more obvious way, given how much success mm-hmm. they've had running the series over all these years. I think, too, in terms of writing, like, because assuming it makes enough money that Sony wants to do a sequel, I think it would really benefit from having a really distinct voice writing the sequel. And my mind immediately goes to like a writer director like James Gunn or Taika Waititi.
You love James Gunn and Taika Waititi.
Picking obvious examples of like people, writer director mm-hmm. filmmakers who have like a very distinct style that you can immediately say, yeah, yep, okay, like sharp comedy writing. Good handle on action, you know, obviously James Gunn and Taika Waititi are the two like most prominent examples of that, but there's other people too. Even Ruben Fleischer, you know, with Zombieland and Zombieland 2, you know, he was a good pick to actually get this thing across the finish line, even if he's dealing with a script that's been modded so many times over the years. If they can go into a sequel with and just like stick to like one or two writers and not have it be so confused, I think they would be on a better foot.
Mm-hmm. And let's keep in mind, Fleischer directed Venom as well, which I think was a very messy movie in a lot of ways, but he makes it work and he did the same thing here. It's a competent movie. I think I gave it 3 out of 5 on Letterboxd, but you're right. Ultimately, it's a very forgettable movie.
And they should have had a better villain, I think. Hopefully the sequel has some more interesting villain.
Oh,
because...
Oh my God, Antonio Banderas was awful.
Yeah, and if it was almost like they felt like he was awful, and they were like, all right, let's just kill him off as a shock tactic, and it...
And it was even... Well, it was shocking in the sense that, you know, how they did it, but it was like one of the weakest throat slashes I've ever seen in a movie.
No blood, no splatter, just, all right, he's on the ground.
I get they wanted to do the PG-13 movie, but, I mean, could you not have killed that character off in a different... more satisfying way.
I think you could in a PG-13. I feel like you can get away with a lot.
Yeah, kill him off screen or something like that, you know? Like, if you're gonna go through the trouble of, you know, of the character, I can't remember the character's name that killed him.
Oh, Braddock?
So if you're gonna go through the trouble of Braddock, you know, slitting his throat and whatnot, I mean, why make it so PG-13? Like, it almost... kind of threw me for a loop because I was expecting, well, I mean, maybe I've seen too many violent movies, but you almost see like, you're almost expecting like a gush of blood, fountain of blood, right? And that's what happens. But no, Banderas just has like a red line across his neck. And I mean, it didn't feel very accurate or real or dangerous. So yeah, I mean, I actually like Chloe though, the supporting character. I just thought she wasn't in it enough in the end.
And I mean, given that I think she's a recurring character in the game series, right?
Yes, she is.
Yeah. So I mean, they'll obviously have her back if they do a sequel. And they apparently have ideas for one because Mark Wahlberg's already grown out the mustache or been given a mustache for that mid-credits scene.
I totally missed that. I only found out there's a mid-credit scene afterwards. They got to stop doing that. Cuz like once the credits roll, I'm gone. See ya.
You're out. Yeah. Well, you know, there's not to do an unpaid promotion, but there's a site called aftercredits.com where you can check ahead of time or while you're sitting in the credits, like to see if it's worth sitting through.
It's just extra effort that I never had, like, got into the habit of doing. And you know what? I blame Marvel.
Oh, yeah. It's on them 100%. Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Everyone's got to have a cinematic universe now.
I know. It's crazy. But, you know, I read that Mark Wahlberg only has a one... picture deal with them,
maybe he wasn't super like
well, he was probably taking like a wait and see
approach, that's right? What I was thinking. Yeah
but now that he's seen that, hey, it's like it's actually making money, maybe he can ask for more. Actually, before we move on, I just want to get your quick thoughts about all the other actors that are being considered for Sully, because it is a wide range. So
I haven't read into this, so just drop some names on me.
Okay, first one, Bryan Cranston.
Okay, I mean, it
could work.
Skews older, I guess that would be more in line with what we see in the games.
Plus he feels more threatening, right? Like if him and Drake are gonna have an adversarial relationship sometimes, he works.
Yes. Yep.
The other was Jake Gyllenhaal. Oh. I can't see it.
No.
Yeah. Chris Pratt, can't see it.
No, definitely not.
Chris Pine, too young.
Yes.
I can't see it either. Chris Hemsworth.
No.
I feel like he's more like a good comedic actor, not like a serious mentor type.
Yeah, but again, too young. Like there's what, a 10-year age gap between him and Tom Holland?
Yeah, maybe. Yeah. Matthew McConaughey.
Oh yeah, I can see that.
Yeah. Could work. But I feel like McConaughey would just be like he would be the focus rather than Tom Holland.
Yeah, you would have to have like a good director and a good script that didn't allow him to kind of like run away with it.
Yeah. And the last one I want to throw at you was Woody Harrelson. I thought this one was interesting.
I could see Woody Harrelson in that role. He's played like mentor. Like, I mean, he did that in the Solo. Like he could. Yeah.
And he worked with Ruben Fleischer and Zombieland and Venom.
Sure.
Too.
Yeah.
So
yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah. So I think there is like they definitely have some sort of relationship there. Mm-hmm. Mark Wahlberg is fine. It's just hard to unsee Mark Wahlberg as Mark Wahlberg.
Yes. Yeah. So, I mean, kudos to him for getting another IP under his belt. Yeah, I know he's a hard worker, that guy.
Yeah, I fear for Tom Holland, though. Two IPs. One so ingrained in my memory as Spider-Man. Maybe just because I just recently saw No Way Home. Maybe that's it.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I could see him taking like a really different role, like indie movie type role in the future, just to like maybe break the glass a little bit.
Yeah, he should really test himself because there is definitely a threat that he'll get a little typecast. He tried doing like an artsy movie for Netflix called The Devil All the Time, which I didn't see. Mm-hmm. I heard relatively good things about it, but mm-hmm. it was also apparently quite depressing. So yeah, it didn't jump immediately to the top of my list. But talking about artsy movies, how about Licorice Pizza? There's nowhere
to be seen. So how'd you become such a hotshot actor?
I'm a showman. That's what I'm meant to do. To the seats with the clearest view.
Then she's hooked to the silver screen. Do you know who I am?
Yeah.
Do you know who my girlfriend is?
Barbra Streisand?
Barbra Streisand.
Sand.
Sand, yeah, like sands. Like the ocean, like
beaches. Barbra Streisand?
No, like Streisand.
Sand.
Actually, you know what? Paul Thomas Anderson directing Uncharted would be a really funny result, I think.
Yeah. I can't see him volunteering for that job, but maybe if he...
Only if it's like set in the San, you know, Fernando Valley or whatever it is.
Yeah, he has a bit of a fixation on that.
Well, it's where he grew up, right? Yeah. But you want to do the setup then for Licorice Pizza?
Sure. So Licorice Pizza is that's the newest movie from Paul Thomas Anderson, a director that Jason and I both like quite a bit. You know, he's kind of fallen into a pretty predictable rhythm the past couple of years. He always takes like 3 or 4 years between projects. But when he does release something, it's obviously a labor of love and packed with all sorts of great performers. I have a hard time describing the style of his movies. Like if you were to say like to somebody who had never seen a Paul Thomas Anderson movie before, how you describe all of his movies? I mean, they're usually very character driven. They don't necessarily have common themes other than...
Certain settings do. I think the look and feel of his movies definitely do. The pacing, he has a very unique pace. And the storytelling is very interesting, too. Like, he lets things really, like, unfold before you.
Yes.
He does a really good job of that. And, I mean, quirky is a really bad word to describe anything. But in every single of his movies, he's always got like an oddball character.
Or sometimes several who are just...
Or several, yeah. Right? Yeah.
They don't feel like movie characters. They feel like...
Exactly. Yeah. It's almost surreal.
Yeah.
And it's very self-referential, I find, sometimes. Maybe not so much in The Phantom Thread, but certainly, say, like Boogie Nights, Licorice Pizza. Yeah.
Punch Drunk Love.
Very tonally, similar, I think.
Yeah. So this movie in particular, this is a quasi autobiographical movie in the sense that you've got a young entrepreneur, a young striver played by Cooper Hoffman, who's the young son of the late Philip Seymour Hoffman. And Cooper Hoffman plays Gary Valentine, who is this high schooler growing up in the San Fernando Valley in the 1980s.
70s. It's 70s, I think.
In the 1970s. Thank you. Growing up in the San Fernando Valley in the 1970s, who he's just an absolute like electric wit, you know, it doesn't matter what people throw at him, what sort of, roadblocks he encounters. He's got an answer for everything. He's thinking 15 steps ahead of everybody. And he crosses paths with a character named Alana, who is 25. She's like 10 years older than him. And when they meet, they're at his high school, and she's a photographer's assistant for the guy taking school portraits. And he's immediately smitten with her, despite the age gap. And he resolves that he is going to make her his, even though there's, you know, a bit of inherent creepiness in like a high schooler being into an older woman like that, older woman. I mean, she's in her 20s, but she's not interested in him romantically at all, certainly for the majority of the movie. And she makes it very clear that they're not dating and she would prefer the relationship to be platonic. But the movie just follows them as they kind of stumble around the valley in this particular time period. And they try to, you know, come up with get rich quick schemes, and they cross paths with kooky characters and
based on real life characters.
Oh, yeah. They would have to be, given how weirdly real everything feels. The like John Peters, for example, played by Bradley Cooper, like he's a real life movie producer who is a total nut job.
Oh my. Well, same with the politician walks. He's a real politician too.
Oh, okay, cool. Yeah. And yeah, it just it has this, to use a very belabored term, it has this slice of life vibe that
I like that because it's about pizza.
And the title, of course, refers to vinyl, which you know, you hear lots of needle drops in this movie, lots of great soundtrack selections, and you know, it's a long movie. It's not for everybody. Some people would be looking for a little more action or more set pieces.
It's way too long, in my opinion.
I was wrapped up in it. I didn't really feel like it was dragging its feet. But I can see how some people would.
Yeah, this is a movie that I think we're going to have to disagree.
Let's establish a baseline then. Like, I went 4.5 out of 5.
I think I went 3.5.
Okay, so you're okay. Yeah, you're coming behind that full star. All right.
Yeah. I'm a half star behind you or ahead of you for Uncharted.
Yes.
So yep. This is one of the rare times where like there is a bit of a more divide between us.
Even though I'm coming in positive, like pretty positive on it, it's not necessarily the kind of movie that I would jump to rewatch. Yeah. I could see myself rewatching it maybe, say, 5 years down the road, but it's not something that I would like immediately.
So the reason, you know, I kind of went under is because it's too niche of a film to me. It really reminded me of Under the Silver Lake. Do you remember that?
Yeah, although I like this a lot more than that.
Well, yes, this is way better than Under the Silver
Lake. Okay.
Like, no question. But this is like the rare Paul Thomas Anderson movie where I don't actively like. Mm. Like, it's a fine film. I loved Inherent Vice when a lot of people didn't. So maybe I just skew more towards the weirder stuff.
No. I don't know. I think between the two of them, I would rewatch Inherent Vice a lot more readily.
Yeah. And I think Boogie Nights is way better.
Yes. As a film. Agreed.
Yeah. So, I mean, let's start with the title first. Licorice Pizza. Licorice Pizza is a famous record store chain back in the day in California. It's a nostalgic sort of name. I don't even know if it's around. If it is, it's not nearly as big as it was before. And so Licorice Pizza, you're right. It refers to vinyl records because it's black and it's round like a pizza pie. Mm. Where it kind of loses me, though, is if you didn't grow up in the Valley, if you're not really steeped in California culture, you had no idea what it was. Right. And Licorice Pizza was named for nostalgic reasons by Thomas Anderson because this is very much an autobiographical film. And it wasn't really advertised that way. So maybe if it was advertised that way, then I'd have a better understanding of it.
Yeah.
I think it just meanders a little bit too much. It's one of those things where, like, if I had a better idea who John Peters was, if I knew more about, you know, Walks the politician, it would have spoke to me a bit more. It's not, I think, a movie with a lot of wide appeal, although I can see the merits of it. So you talked about Alana, played by Alana Haim from Haim, the music band. She is fantastic.
Yeah, for a first time role, I mean, yeah, she feels like she's been acting her whole life.
Well, I mean, yeah, she's got like a great stage presence because their band with the three sisters.
Sure.
They have been performing for a while now. And Cooper Hoffman really impressed me because he really has some acting chops. And I read that he didn't even want to do the film in the first place.
Oh, sure. Yeah. Yeah. Because again, like no previous on-screen experience other than maybe some cameos, I think, here and there. But yeah, like the two of them are just like, they're such a well-defined unit on the screen.
They do look very good together. I think it was very much, I don't want to say like a product of its time, but there's a lot of casual sexism and racism in it that I didn't always find very funny.
Yeah, what was your take on the those couple of scenes where...
with the Japanese wife?
The Japanese wife, yeah. Because I know that David Chen wrote on Letterboxd, like, you know, he's a fairly prominent film writer, and he gave the film 4 stars, but he slammed the Japanese scenes as, like, you know, it puts the audience, and especially, like, white people in the audience, in this kind of situation where you understand that you're not supposed to side with the racist guy, but you're laughing at how overtly racist it is. So you're still
And how dumb he is.
And so you're still laughing, but it still puts you in like a tricky position.
So that's another weird dynamic, which is again why I called it a bit of a niche film. So in the theater I was in, it wasn't very populated, but I was like the only minority in there.
Right.
And when that scene came on, the only person who laughed, or the only laughter I heard, was from a white dude, an old white dude.
Okay.
So that kind of, I think, spoke to me and talks to David's point about how this is only funny to a certain group of people.
Yeah.
And that's the old white male.
Yeah. But it's like, the question, I guess, falls on an individual level, too. It's like, you will have older white dudes who are laughing at the joke because they fundamentally find it funny.
Yeah.
And then you have people like me who I was kind of grinning and wincing at the kind of secondhand embarrassment of it.
Yeah.
Of like, you know, if I was in that situation, I would find that really horrible to witness.
It's uncomfortable.
But you kind of laugh as a way of like relieving the tension.
So I didn't really laugh. I kind of chuckled and I thought it was a weird joke to make. I understood what Paul Thomas Anderson was trying to do, though. It was very much common behavior back in the day.
Yeah.
And so was the photographer basically sexually assaulting Alana.
Yes. Yes.
A lot of people have made the comparison of that. What was the character's name?
The restaurant.
The old
restaurant owner?
Yeah, the restaurateur. Yeah.
I can't remember.
But anyway, so the comparison was him versus Steve Carell in The Office.
Okay.
Where you have two really dumb people who are inadvertently racist or sexist or for whatever reason. Now, the difference between Michael Scott and the character in Licorice Pizza is that in The Office, Michael Scott often becomes the brunt of many jokes. Like, it's painfully obvious that people think very little of him.
Yes.
We never get that sense in Licorice Pizza. So yes, we are supposed to laugh at him, but the movie never tells you explicitly to laugh at him.
Yeah, I can see that.
It's almost as if like you're laughing with him in a sense, because you're laughing at the whole situation. But it's up to you to decide that he is the dumb person, instead of in The Office, where everyone knows that Michael Scott is the dumb person in that scene.
Right, right.
So I think that's where the dynamic kind of changes. As like a minority and as an Asian and like someone who is pretty familiar with Japanese culture, those kind of jokes I feel like are kind of like low hanging fruit to me.
Yeah.
And it's just, I get it. I chuckled. It's common behavior in that era. But I also felt that the movie worked without that scene anyway. I didn't quite understand the purpose. Again, this goes back to my point about this movie being kind of long. Like, it actually felt like 3 hours to me sometimes.
Yeah, you could almost, like, you could make the argument for cutting stuff like that, because while it does paint the picture of the time and place,
it doesn't further Alana or Gary's character.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I mean, it furthers the plot along in the sense that Gary's trying to do business with all sorts of weird people. But I mean, you already have Sean Penn in there, you have Tom Waits in there, you have Bradley Cooper in there, and they all kind of do the same thing.
Yeah, so it's repetitive in the sense, and like it kind of gets to, I mean, weirdly, it reminds me of Mank.
Okay, yeah, no, actually, that's a good
comparison. It's an auteur movie that is packed with all these little references that are meaningful to the filmmaker. For whatever reason, you know, because they either, you know, in Paul Thomas Anderson's case, he grew up in this environment, or in David Fincher's case, you know, he's trying to fulfill the vision of his dad, who had tried to make a movie like who was, and, you know, super familiar with the characters who were in the world of Mank. But yeah, to the average audience picking it up with no background, you're like, okay, maybe these pieces don't necessarily need to be here. So yeah, I see that.
So like a little inside kind of like tidbit too, is that Paul Thomas Anderson, when he was growing up, one of his teacher was Alana Himes' mom.
Oh, okay. So he knew the Himes like well, and
And he wrote this role specifically for Alana Himes.
Right.
Which I mean was a great decision in retrospect. So I mean, the acting I get, the original screenplay I get, best picture, I mean, it's a 10 film field, so I get it. But it doesn't really crack the top five for me. But the one thing I kind of wanted to ask you about was the age difference. Now, to me, Alana Himes is playing a 25-year-old, but she's very immature.
Yes.
And Cooper Hoffman doesn't look 15. So it never felt awkward to me. But it became like a really big debate outside of the film. Sure. What did you make of that?
I feel like the people online who were very upset about it were making a bit of a mountain out of a molehill, as people often do.
Could you imagine the roles were reversed? Like gender roles?
There would have been a...
Where it's like an older dude with like a really...
There would have been like, a louder outcry for sure. But still, people... I think a lot of people were trying to get points online by calling it out or by being
woke, quote unquote.
Yeah, I mean,
woke.
You call it what you will, but yeah, they were trying to make a big splash, get some clout, you know, whatever. But ultimately, like, yeah, there's what's the worst thing that happens? Like, do they kiss?
They kiss at the very end, which I don't know. Do you feel like it kind of ruined the movie for you? I feel like it kind of did. I kind of like the fact that they were platonic the entire time.
Yeah, I would have been fine if they stayed platonic, you know, the... Yeah, and I mean, it's not really answered one way or the other. Like, who knows? Given their relationship through the rest of the movie, like, you could pick up the story the next day and they hate each other again.
Yeah.
They, you know, so.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, they have such a fractious relationship that, you know, whatever is presented as, like, the happy ending here could flitter away. But,
like, the physical age, there's a 10-year difference. But the mental age, I feel like they're both on the same level.
Sure, yeah. Because and that's half the story is, like, you know, Gary Valentine is wise beyond his years. He's, you know,
as a child actor. Yeah.
And preternaturally like capable of jumping into the world head first. And no matter what people throw at him, he's going to come out on top. Somehow he may have his losses along the way, but whatever. Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, Alana arguably could have started her life and been in a job and, you know, been more established by that point. And, you know, given housing prices in the 1970s, she probably could be a homeowner, you know? But she's still living at home with her family and whatever. And
played by her real family, by the way.
Exactly. Yeah. Which is, you know, another great little detail, but yeah, and here she is hanging out with high schoolers. So that's kind of the core of the story is showing these two very different people who are, you know, their ages don't line up with their mm-hmm. maturity, basically.
I just didn't find it distracting. Like a lot of people did.
No, I didn't really find it distracting. I was, you know, I knew about the quote unquote controversy going into the screening. I was looking for it, but I didn't find anything that really scared me. So,
yeah, I mean, it really helps that Cooper Hoffman looks older than 15. I mean, he's 18 in real life, but
if he looked like the kids from like Stranger Things, maybe it would have, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. I feel like in certain ways, Tom Holland looks younger than him.
Mm, yeah. Yeah. He's got that kind of like the broad shoulders of his dad and the wide features. And
this is going to sound terrible, and I'm not really disparaging anyone, but I think it's interesting that in a lot of Paul Thomas Anderson films, especially this one, he casts very normal looking people. Mm-hmm. Like they're not models from a page, you know?
Yeah.
And I think that really works for this movie because it's about maybe not imperfect, but like terrible people in a certain sense.
Yeah. Yeah. People who are like, yeah, they you wouldn't necessarily see them succeed in Hollywood or whatever. And they're the people who kind of make the rest of the Southern California run.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. I do like some of the historical references, you know, like the oil crisis with no gas.
Yeah.
The waterbed, you know, being part of it and the pinball arcade he opens up.
I thought
those were really interesting. But I just like putting you on the spot here, but in the pantheon of Paul Thomas Anderson movies, where does this
is the rank? Bottom tier, I think, but I mean,
yeah, same here.
Like yeah, he's so good, he's so consistently good.
Agreed, right? So it's the bar is so high
for me. It's a little bit like Wes Anderson actually in The French Dispatch. I mean, generally speaking, I rate all of his movies a lot higher, and Wes Anderson on a bad day is better than so many other filmmakers, and that's kind of the case with this other Anderson. You know, you would put Licorice Pizza above many, many films that come out over the course of the year, but still, compared with Boogie Nights and There Will Be Blood and Magnolia and all the others, like this is definitely, you know, further down the list.
Do you think this has a shot?
Not at Best Picture. I think it's too weird. The Academy is probably going to go pretty obvious this year, whether that's West Side Story or something of that caliber. I don't see something kind of off kilter like this.
Really, eh? West Side Story.
I
thought you were going to pick Power of the Dog or something like that. It just has so many political points going for it.
No, I think the Academy wants something uplifting this year, and Power of the Dog is, you know, as we said before, it's technically very good, but I don't think it's gonna get the prize unless
Something crazy happens. It's hard to say because, like, as we've read in Vanity Fair over the years, not all the voters watch every single movie.
No, that's true. And the Academy's dealing with another controversy now as we speak with this decision to not show 8 categories during the telecast. They're going to...
Well, not live. I think they're going to film it and then edit it and then put it in the broadcast, but it's not going to be live.
All the people who represent those disciplines are up in arms now, and they, you know, some of them are threatening to resign from the Academy and all kinds of stuff. So, you know.
I love how the Oscars create controversy for themselves to drive up interest.
Yeah, it seems to be the only way they know how to get people to watch the show is like, who's angry at us now?
Yeah. I mean, it's really interesting.
Well, we'll definitely be talking more about the Oscars next month because it's coming up at the end of March, and more of the precursor awards will have been handed out by that point. So we'll get a sense of where the voters are going. Next week's episode will obviously be very much centered around The Batman, another thing we've been waiting for for a while. Clocking in at, I think, 2 hours 44 minutes. So it's a...
Yeah, there's a lot of ground to cover because there's at least 2 major characters and at least 2 side... One major villain, one secondary villain.
Variety was trying to make a case for, like, oh, we're in this age of super long movies nowadays. And to an extent, they're...
It's kind
of
true.
They're sort of right, but also, like, The Dark Knight Rises, which came out 8 years or 10 years ago... that was like only 3 minutes longer than The Batman. So
also, like, have they not heard of Terrence Malick?
Yeah.
Even Drive My Car, Japanese films, like Tokyo Story is a 4-hour film, and that came out in like the black and white.
Yeah, era. I don't know. I feel like it's kind of like they're zooming in a bit too much, you know?
Yeah, I can see like mainstream films being, you know, longer than necessary.
Yeah. Yeah.
In that sense, actually, Uncharted actually kind of moved at a pretty quick clip.
Yeah.
I mean, there are parts that were very cliched and very predictable.
Sure.
I was never completely bored like I was in certain parts of Licorice
Pizza.
No, it's true. Like, hey, there are some parts in Licorice Pizza where I was like, we need to move on.
Yeah, yeah. No, there will definitely be some art house lovers who are upset with that comment, but what are you going to do?
Well, this same with Under the Silver Lake. I don't understand the hype.
Nope, I don't get it either. That one is... I can't remember which prominent filmmaker it was who said that they adored it. It might have been like Guillermo del Toro.
I thought David Ehrlich loved
it. He might have, but I think it was Guillermo del Toro said that he loved it. And
to each their own, right?
Yeah, it's packed with all of those like insider, like old school Hollywood things that I can sort of see why he'd be into it, but whatever.
Also, like way more hipster than Licorice Pizza.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. Trying for that like fake film noir stuff.
I feel like you hate Under the Silver Lake more than I do.
It's possible. I remember actively disliking it the more I watched of it.
Did you hear about the good reviews before going in?
I heard it was very mixed going in. That was the vibe I got.
Oh, okay. That was me too. But I mean, going into Licorice Pizza, I heard it was very good. And Paul Thomas Anderson being, you know, a big fan.
Yeah.
Having like some of his like really dramatic stuff, I found this a little lacking.
Yeah. But yeah. Well, that does it for Licorice Pizza. So, yeah, come on back next episode, which will be about The Batman and other things, if we have time to cram them in.
No, we won't. I guarantee you we won't.
It might be another Dune-style episode where we're just fixated on the one thing. But, hey, whatever. This is our show.
Well, 2 hours and 44 minutes, there's plenty to talk about.
Yeah. How do you expect us
to... I mean, I could go on for half an hour about the Riddler, so...
How do you expect us to cut that down to under 60 minutes?
Well, sucks to be you, Rob.
Yeah, sucks to be me. All right, well, until that next episode, my name is Robert Snow in Toronto.
And my name is Jason Chen in Vancouver. Thank you for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.
The Extra Buttery Podcast is written, recorded, and produced by Jason Chen and Robert Snow. Thank you for listening, and don't forget to rate and subscribe on the podcast platform of your choice. And remember, popcorn is always better with extra butter.